Hello and welcome to Real Talk, where curiosity chases truth. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, and I am fortunate on this Real Talk special to have with me Christopher Blackwell, who is an award-winning journalist, executive director, and co-founder of an organization called Look to Justice. It's a Washington State nonprofit we'll hear more about, and the author of a book that is about to be published titled Ending Isolation, The Case Against Solitary Confinement. Welcome, Chris. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Suzanne. It's an honor to be here with you and your listeners.
And tell us where you are right now.
Well, I could be found sitting at a desk looking out a prison window at some razor wire because I'm incarcerated at the Washington Correction Center.
Where?
In Shelton, Washington.
In Shelton. And listeners, we have a slight delay on this Zoom call, so please bear with us. Chris, first of all, tell me why I'm talking to you. You are doing something very special with the publication of your book, Ending Isolation. What's going on with that in September?
Well, we will be launching a national tour and campaign against the use of solitary confinement in the United States. And we will be working to educate society and a lot of our people out in the community. They just don't understand exactly what solitary is and what it does and the impacts that it has on people when they're coming home from prison systems. You know, and we want to make sure that we are helping people understand the harm that it's causing and that, you know, it's really not a benefit to society as a whole. And we think that teaching people about this and helping to educate them will help them see that. And given I was incarcerated for the first time at the age of 12, and that was the first time I experienced solitary, now being 44 years old and with almost 30 years of incarceration under my belt, not something I'm gratefully proud of, but something that it has been an experience. I want to share that with people. I want to help us. I want to help us get to a better place.
Thank you. And the Guardian newspaper has given your book an incredibly positive review, starting with the fact that solitary confinement is internationally recognized as a form of torture. You wrote this book with, I believe, four different co-authors. Tell me how and why you recruited those people.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, thanks to The Guardian for that. That was a real blessing for them to do that. And it is me and three other co-authors. So it's myself and Quinetta Harris, who's an incarcerated journalist in Texas. And I wanted me and Quinetta's voice because they offer a different, you know, angle of this book. Quinetta as a woman who's experienced solitary from that perspective, which is vastly different than what males experience while inside. And then also from my angle, you know, and Quinetta just experienced almost 9 consecutive years in solitary confinement for her quote unquote celebrity status. Nothing that was a threat or harm. And then within that, it was actually originally me and Professor Debbie Zalesny, who started wanting to put this project together, and she's a law professor at CUNY Law. And I wanted Debbie because Debbie can really talk about the angle of the, you know, the constitutional violation of the Eighth Amendment, right, of cruel and unusual punishment. And I thought that it was important for us to recognize that this is a constitutional violation to place people in solitary confinement. And then it was a no-brainer to bring Dr. Terry Coopers in. You know, Dr. Terry Coopers is at the Wright Institute at Berkeley University. Mr. Coopers has been a fierce, you know, advocate and leader in this space since the 60s. You know, he can be traced all the way back to doing work with the Black Panthers Party and, you know, incredible folks and leaders like Angela Davis. But Terry is also one of the top leading experts on the harm of solitary confinement, short and long term. And, you know, anytime there is work around this, Terry is called to testify for that. You know, he's a very strong mind in this space to really help us as a society understand the psychological, the physical, the emotional, and the other impacts that, you know, they keep when we put people in solitary confinement.
So let's go there, Chris. tell us either your personal experience or what you've learned and Dr. Coopers has learned from researching the impacts of solitary confinement. What can you summarize? What are the most common effects psychologically and possibly even physically on people who experience solitary confinement?
I mean, first and foremost is something that's not talked about is it leaves almost every person that experiences it with a form of PTSD, which we know is extremely damaging in, humans, as you know, they have to continue their lives carrying that around with them like a weighted backpack, So we know that that happens. We know that this happens in even very short terms. We know that there's a lot of sensory deprivation that people experience by being inside these environments. People become very reclusive. And that's something that we've noticed in people that do that. So they're very socially awkward. They struggle to be in large impacted settings and stuff like that. So when we think about a person that we want to get out and be able to succeed, right, in the job market and be a productive member of society, how do they do that? And they've been forced to experiencing things that have actually stripped away some of these skills that they're going to need to be successful in these spaces. We want to think about, and that's, think about that. And that's on the basic level. That's just scratching the surface of the harms and traumas that people experience inside solitary confinement.
Yeah, let's go deeper. I want people to understand the torture aspect of this. When you say PTSD, when they're actually released from prison, but on the shorter term, when folks are forced into solitary confinement for periods short or long and still have to return to the prison environment, how are they changed?
I mean, it's, you go from an environment where you're literally confined to a very small space, often the size of a parking space, and you have almost zero interaction with people outside of that, human touch. You're void of all that, right? So, and then when you are put back in like a prison general population, you're thrust into a place that has hundreds of people around you all the time. You have very little personal space, and it can be extremely hard to navigate when your mind is used to living a certain way and you kind of, in solitary, you live in survival mode, right? You're trying to keep your spirit alive. That's not an easy thing to do. And then just to be thrown out into a space where you have all these personalities and all these rules and all these things to navigate and follow, it can be really overwhelming to people. Right. I mean, you even in solitary, you live in a place that's void of all color. The only color you may see is the orange on the jumpsuit you wear. And then you come out into this world and your eyes can barely adjust to all the fast moving things and all the things that are going on. I've even had one of my close friends, Gail Brashear, tell me, she was forced to do excessive amounts of solitary at a very young age, that she had been kept out of the sun for so long that she actually overdosed on vitamin D and the sun and the rays from the sun when she got out of solitary and had to go get medication and have a medical emergency, right? So like it's unhuman, the kinds of level of torture that people experience when they're in those moments and in those kind of environments, and then forced to just be thrown back out into even a semi-normal environment, and it's almost impossible to function or live as a human being.
That's horrible. And I have learned that there are researchers at the University of Washington who are studying the effects of solitary confinement, and they have been prohibited from using rats because the imposition of those elements is too inhumane for rats. So they're using bees, who are more sensitive, as it turns out, to isolation. So I want to go to your personal experience. You were incarcerated for the first time at age 12 and put into solitary confinement. How did that happen? What was it that happened?
Well, I was incarcerated for the first time for a gram of marijuana. which is interesting to even think of in today's world, because it would never happen. And also, I had never gotten out of the grasp of the system since that very day, which also is a very clear indicator of why we don't want our kids coming into the connection with the carceral system. But, you know, what led me to solitary once I was in there is obviously at that age, you know, especially growing up in the neighborhood I did. I grew up in the Hilltop area, Tacoma, in the early 90s, you know, which was a very rough neighborhood. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very rebellious. You know, we were always taught not to, you know, like respect or trust authority. You know, I mean, when people called the police in our neighborhood, they never received help. You know, it usually caused more trouble, more trauma. So, you know, when you have that mindset at such a young age and your brain is so underdeveloped, all you do is rebel against the system because you literally see it as nothing more than your enemy. And that's also been your experience with the system. Right. Every time I had come in contact with the system to that point had never been something that was helpful, beneficial. It was always something that disrupted or caused harm to my life or someone I love's life. So for me, I obviously was in there with a chip on my shoulder. And, you know, we need to be accountable for our actions, you know, but I would act out and things like that, you know, and that would lead to them, you know, being very aggressive and, you know, taking us to solitary confinement as kids. You know, and that's, you know, a snowball effect, right? One thing leads to another, but I can promise what it didn't do. It didn't make me have any more trust or faith in the system. It drove me further in the opposite direction to realize that people that say they were there to have my best interest at heart, they absolutely didn't.
Tell me how our current carceral system justifies the use of solitary confinement, particularly with young people. What do they say is the purpose?
I think a common one that you hear that threads through the juvenile and adult systems and even ICE detention centers and, you know, any of these places where we weaponize solitary confinement would be the safety and security of the institution and the people that reside within it, either that work there or are incarcerated there. But Is it really safer and more secure by torturing someone? I don't see how that could be, right? Like, do people get angry? People need cool down times? I could see that, you know, two individuals get in a fight. You want to put people in a moment where they can cool down and get back to rational decisions and maybe have, you know, some kind of communication after that. Yeah, that sounds logical, right? I think they have that when you look at other civilized countries like in Norway and Germany and some of these places. Like, they use very, very minimal doses of isolation in those moments. But a lot of the time we see people in solitary confinement for smoking weed, you know, for, you know, getting in disagreement with a prison guard, right? And, you know, they tell them to F off or something like that, right? You know, they're very small, minimal things that aren't violent or scary, but then solitary is used as a weapon. So really the only benefit that I see for solitary confinement is that administrators and prison guards can use it as a stick to keep people in line, to never push back, you know, and kind of challenge anything, right? I've seen prison journalists such as myself thrown in solitary confinement for writing articles and things like that. That doesn't seem like someone that's scary and violent. That seems like someone that's trying to educate the public about what's going on inside. And it seems really oppressive and harmful that could be used against someone for doing things like that, right? For exercising their freedom of speech.
Right. Tell me, this might be a really stupid question. Is there any attempt at rehabilitation that is rolled into solitary confinement, how does solitary, if at all, fit into rehabilitation in our prison system?
You can't rehabilitate someone by abusing and oppressing them.
Right.
There's just simply no possible way we can do that. So it works towards the opposite. a goal to get someone to rehabilitate and be accountable and remorseful for the harm they've caused and the trouble they've caused their community is by pulling them out of survival mode. You can't pull someone out of survival mode by abusing them. That's like, I just got to hit my wife a couple of times to get her to see my point. I'm going to pull her out of seeing it that way. You can't harm to get people to not harm, right? You know, it's like an abusive husband or abusive parent or something like that. Like, they don't use more abuse to, you know, fix the situation. That's not fixing the situation. Getting someone to fix the situation is getting someone to be accountable and remorseful for the things that they caused. That's why they're in prison. We do that by working with them, pulling on the threads and the trauma that they need to process and work through so they can better understand those things and understand why they're themselves causing harm. And we just can't get that by harming someone.
Right. I'm talking with Christopher Blackwell, author of Ending Isolation, The Case Against Solitary Confinement. And Chris, you mentioned when we started this that women have a different experience of solitary confinement. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, and this is just me. You know, I was very oblivious. I was very cut off from this myself and even the knowledge around this. So, you know, I'm only speaking through that, you know, incredibly, you know, powerful words of Quinetta Harris and the people that she's speaking on behalf. Quinetta said something one time when we were talking about this, and she was helping, you know, us kind of shape ideas around the book, where we immediately made the decision after she said this, like, you need to have a part in this book because this is different. And I can't speak for that, and neither could anybody else. Is she had told us a story about the countless times she's witnessed women be sexually assaulted, have to either perform sexual acts or offer some kind of sexual favor to get things as simple as toilet paper or a pad when a woman is on her menstrual cycle, because the guards have all the access to these materials, right? And these needs, these necessities, and that if they didn't do that, then they just couldn't receive these things. And that's not that that happens every single time, but it happens a lot and far more than it ever should, because it should never happen.
Correct.
A woman should never be sexually assaulted because they need toilet paper or for any other reason.
Yeah, I agree.
So, you know, when she would tell us these stories, it was mind-blowing, to be honest.
Yeah, I can imagine. And what that speaks to is what sounds like a pervasive sadistic brutality among those guards who are charged with managing solitary confinement. Is there some sort of symbiotic relationship there? Is there something about the brutality of the guards that is exacerbated or is encouraged because of this brutal situation?
I mean, I just think that, you know, and I wouldn't want to put every one of them in the position that they would do something like that, because I don't think every one of them would. But I think that it's overlooked a lot of the time because it's just a prisoner, right?
Yeah.
Why does it matter?
Yeah.
And I think even when they do get caught doing these things, you know, it's like, all right, well, we might punish you a little bit, but again, it's just a prisoner. So it doesn't really matter in a lot of people's minds, and there's just not enough attention on it. And that's the point of the book, right?
Yeah.
Is we want to bring this back in society's forefront. We can't let this sit in the shadows. This needs to be things people understand, and they need to know that every single one of us as taxpayers, we're paying for this to happen. We're allowing this to happen. We're accepting it to happen, and it's time that we stop.
Yeah.
That we say that not in our name, and it doesn't make us safer, and there's no reason for that, and prisons can be ran without that.
And I believe you probably have evidence for other states where solitary confinement has been eliminated or reduced, and the positive effect that has on the carceral system. What sort of evidence do you have of the positive effects of ending solitary confinement?
Well, the hard thing about that is even the states like New Jersey, New York, and, you know, these groundbreaking bills that have passed, you know, like the HALT Act in New York, you know, that they're actively working to repeal right now, they haven't been fully enacted. We've never really seen what it fully looks like. But what we know is that violence was on a downtrend after this stuff, not on an uptrend. You know, it's not punishment that holds people in line. And what we've also seen is that unions and prison administrations have actively fought hard and lobbied hard against taking this tool out of their you know, off their tool belt. So
I can only
we've
imagine
seen a lot of
As a reporter, I follow the money, and I can only imagine that has some sort of financial benefit to the people who are opposing the end of solitary confinement. I also note that your call time is about to end. So, Christopher Blackwell, author of Ending Isolation, The Case Against Solitary Confinement, give us one final statement, if you can, a summary or a call to action that we as taxpayers who don't want to pay for torture anymore can take with us.
Get involved. Get involved. The book highlights a lot of ways to get involved. It has calls to action in it. Share the book in your community. We have, you know, big events coming up in September. You know, on we have one of the biggest ones on September 13th. At Town Hall in Seattle. Come down there with us, hear from survivors, hear from Representative Strom
Peterson.
You have
1 minute left.
Hear from Representative Strom Peterson, who's been running the bills to try to end this, you know, and learn firsthand.
Christopher Blackwell, thank you so much for your time. And I'd like to know more about how you see your future. I think we'll have another conversation. You've been listening to a Real Talk special about ending solitary confinement.